Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Keeping It Cool, Solving Military Electronics Thermal Management Challenges. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems Magazine and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Jerry Janicki, Senior Director of Mega Defense Systems, and David Omar, Director of Program Management Military Products at Contron. Now, before we get started, I have some housekeeping announcements. The eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Before we get going, I want to point out three important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you will be able to view the slides in full screen mode. The second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The third button on your console allows you to enter questions in real time. We will do our best to answer these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a specific question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I will hand out the questions equally to our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now I'm pleased to turn over to our first speaker, Jerry Janicki of Mega Defense Systems. Jerry, take it away.
Thank you, John. And on behalf of Mega Defense Systems, I want to thank you for inviting us to this webcast and thank you, Contron, for sponsoring this. Now, what I'd like to do this morning is to take you through what I call a systems-level approach. It's going to be a top-down approach to looking at the cooling of electronics on military platforms. My friend David O'Mara will be talking about more of a bottoms-up approach, and hopefully these approaches will meet in the middle. A quick outline, I'm going to give you a quick overview, go through military system needs, subsystem needs, and I'll give you definitions of all these, system challenges, subsystem solutions, and finally a summary. Now, as we look to the future, and there's the pictures of some F-22s flying, it's important to note that the current and planned exponential growth in military platform electronics is truly driving cooling requirements from several kilowatts to several hundred kilowatts. In fact, just last week, a study was released by IPC. It was a PCB technology trend where 148 manufacturers of PC boards were asked, what is the greatest challenge between now and 2019? And it was always thermal. Thermal management and thermal design limiting factors in their design of boards. Now, network-centric warfare has been driving the development of and the functional density of electronics, as you see in these fifth-generation fighters, which were actually developed back in 1986 in terms of if you look at the competition for that fighter, so making it almost close to 30 years old, that the sixth-generation fighters will also be implementing newer technologies in high-energy weapons, which will increase the problem of cooling on these next-generation aircraft. Thermal management really is mission critical today. Subsystems in support of electronics and combat vehicles and high energy weapons. And finally, good thermal management is really benign. Nobody knows about it. Nobody hears about it. You don't think about it if it works. But when it doesn't work, it can ruin your day. So we stop at the top level in terms of the boundary conditions around most military platforms, and I'm going to be specifically talking about aircraft platforms and ground vehicle platforms. Naval platforms aren't as big an issue because they have a very large heat sink where they could dump their heat into called the ocean. So, but mostly for aircraft and ground vehicles, I'll be using those two as examples, both current vehicles and some conceptual future vehicles. If you look at the operational boundary conditions and design limits for aircraft, it's based upon its flight envelope, okay? That's its altitude it's flying at, the speed it's flying at, and that envelope within that. It's the size, weight, which is critical in military aircraft, power, because all cooling systems require power, the dynamic loads, the operating temperatures, you know, minus 55 degrees C up to plus 85 degrees C, and storage temperatures, which can be greater than that. And then finally, reliability, maintainability, and most important, cost. Whereas ground vehicles have similar requirements. We'll talk a lot about SWAP, size, weight, and power, and its impact in the system, because no one wants to pay for the cooling system. The cooling systems, again, use power, they take up space, they take up weight, and they actually reduce the range of most of these vehicles. But you can't go anywhere without them, based upon today's electronics and the heat generated by them. So with ground vehicles, it's, again, vibrational loads, operations, storage temperatures, reliability, maintainability, and cost. So the most challenging application, though, over the last few years has not been just C4ISR. Today, it's these high-energy weapons. We're talking about weapons like electromagnetic, you know, rail guns, and more importantly, these high-energy lasers, what they're looking at from going from 10 kilowatts to 100 kilowatts to up to 150 kilowatts and putting them both on aircraft and ground vehicles. So the challenge for the future are really a bunch of things. It includes not only the technical challenges, but there are political challenges, there are economic challenges, and obsolescence-based challenges. And the two pictures you see there is an Air Force concept for an energy weapon on a B-1 and a ground weapon system, the HEW system. So let's look at an aircraft first. The operational impact in terms of flight envelope limitations for thermal management. You see a typical flight profile for a supersonic aircraft. The green line represents what we can operate back with a refrigerant like 236, which is for higher condensing temperatures. Remember, you go in supersonic, you pick up a lot of aerothermal loads, and condensing temperatures at Mach 1.8 can reach as high as 220 degrees. And therefore, you're within a green line. But remember, thermal has its transient response. So for 1 minute, you could fly out to the red and still be able to recover with the thermal management system. 5 minutes at the blue and then at the yellow. Then you have the 30-minute profile here. Again, but these systems are not just single systems. This represents the cooling of a vapor cycle system and a ram air cooling system, because we find the best approach today in terms of meeting the requirements for aircraft are hybrid systems, those systems where you can switch off the ram air system, switch off the vapor cycle system, or just go into ground mode to best utilize the power, which is really a premium on these aircraft. Now, if we look at it, all of these things are limited by SWAP, the size, weight, and available power. And so the development of efficient hybrid thermal systems that will drive a cooling system that can provide either cold air or cold liquid to the electronics is paramount. Even as you go higher into space, you have the issues that are combined with not only SWAP, but thermal conductance at altitude versus thermal resistance altitude. You see when you get to about 100,000 feet, you're entering the edge of space. And, you know, space station flying at 250 nautical miles up, it has its own issues. But you have to be able to design for these things. Remember, when an airplane's flying at approximately 8,000, 9,000 feet, the density of the air is about two-thirds of what it is on the ground. And at about 28,000 feet, it's about 50%. So you have to take that all into account in the design of a cooling system, whether it be the fan, the airflow, and the density of the air, plus the mechanical equipment being used on that system. So when we look at a multi-level solution set and looking at what it's starting at, I'm showing here a picture of some platforms. When I talk to the platform level, this gray level, these are some example platforms where we put thermal systems on. Now, there's a lot more platforms. Mega Defense has thermal management systems on, but many of them are classified. Several are proprietary. But let's just say there are a lot of unmanned systems out there today with demands for advanced cooling systems. Now, when you have the increasing functional density of that, we have to be able to develop thermal management system, which is a vapor cycle or ram air cooling system or whatever is used to remove the heat from the LRU or the board to the outside to be the most cost-effective, weight-effective, and SWAP-effective systems. So even though I talk about board level a little bit of component, I'm leaving most of it up to Dave O'Mara, it's all the same. Heat transfer is basically the mass times the specific heat of that material you're trying to transfer through to the delta T. And if you can remember some very simple physics here, I'm not going to get into CFD or talk about advanced tools here, but from a very top level, you know, delta Q is still extremely important at all levels. And when you're moving heat from the board to the box to the system to outside the airplane, you have to understand that. You can't just optimize for one of those systems. It's like squeezing jello. The thermal load has to go somewhere. Now, today we're talking about much more effective aircraft engines like the GEXX, which will put out 500 kVA but no bleed air, making a more electric system. But even a system like that, if the generator is 95% efficient on a 1-megawatt system, you still got 50 kilowatts just for the generator to remove. So the heat problem is multiplying and multiplying quickly. Here is an impact from just the basic storage and operation temperature of components that go on a board. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but in terms of you can clearly reduce the total cost of the electronic system and the cooling system if you can set needs around the red dotted line, which is really driving it more towards a commercial operation. In fact, if you could lower the temperature requirements, you can make a box system and everything else have multiplying effects. But it's very difficult to do that with mill standards calling out for minus 55 to plus 85 for operation for rugged systems and up to 125 for storage on some space and some other systems. So when we look at what the design cost performance is, when we look at how you cool something, do you use air, do you use conduction, do you use radiation, and many times it's all multiplications of all of those things, it's truly driven by what the lowest power requirement is to provide that much cooling, and it takes in the coefficient of performance and the basic swap areas to make it work. Now, a lot of people talk about not just swap, but swap C, where they add cost in it. Cost is always a driver. But if you look at this very simple chart, which is looking at cooling capacities to cooling cost, all of these systems, even a forced liquid system, which is a what I call a passive system, can be very, very expensive if it's applied wrong. We look at the active systems of being refrigerated liquid systems, direct refrigeration, and immersion, okay, as a way of providing these cooling methods. But many of these are impractical because you still, even with a spray cooled or immersion cooled electronic box, you have to take the heat from the cooling system still out to the subsystem and then out to the aircraft somehow. So as we look at this, there are always many ways of cooling things. And again, every couple of years, you know, some of the technology recycled or the technology du jour from a laboratory university pops up and new jet impingement cooling or microchannel cooling comes up. But it's all the same. You still have to go from the component and board, whether you're using spray cooling, direct refrigeration, thermal baddies, thermal siphons, liquid flow through, and air flow through into the system, which really drives the way we do cool. And the most effective way to cooling is the simplest way of cooling. If you can cool directly with air, great, but today's functional densities do not allow us to do that. In fact, forced liquid and forced air tend to be the methods today, but a vapor cycle assisted forced liquid or vapor cycle assisted forced air actually helps because it can help reduce the overall size, improve the overall performance, and give you a better trade and return if it's applied properly. Now, where is it dumped to? It's dumped to things like external air through ram air, through fuel and structure, and new advanced hybrid systems. So if we look at the system, when it goes out there, it'll have to be supported by the engine. And in years, bleed air, which was readily available on lots of older engines, is no longer as available. So we see the more electrified aircraft and even ground vehicle, the operation of it, the auxiliary loads, and then the duty cycle for that system. But again, it's all about size, weight, and power, cost, and then finally life cycle. Now, if air and liquid are the most effective ways of cooling on military platforms today and really tomorrow, then you have to look at the coolant media. And here's some examples in terms of the thermal conductivity of some of these systems and their capacity. Now, water is still one of the best ways of moving things, even though nanoparticle solutions like copper-infused liquids and diamond and graphite are out there being tested, but none are really implemented on military platforms. Typically, you see today either PAO, because of its dielectric properties, or a combination of EGW and PGW systems on current aircraft and even ground vehicles. Now, the applications of those liquids in forced air could be cold plates, microchannels, thermal siphons. You can still boil it if you have the right materials. And even combinations of liquid air and thermoelectric have been challenged. Now, thermoelectric is a really nice concept and principle for cooling, but its effectiveness and efficiency just isn't there as compared to vapor cycle systems or even just ram air. Now, here's just a quick example. David O'Meara is going to go through this in a lot more detail, but here from electric board chassis, here's just a simple chassis with a black backplane being pulled out the back. This is a simple flow-through chassis, whether it be flow-through of air or water. You're still relying on the board and really the wedge lock for taking the thermal loads out to whatever you're sending through with the convection and conduction currents. Now, we treat this as a very simple resistance diagram. If you have programs like FlowTherm and all these and a lot of thermal analysis programs, we prefer those. But just to keep it simple for you to understand how heat is transferred, this is a good example. So if we look at it, there's several laws. I mean, we have both conduction, convection, and radiation. I'm covering just conduction and convection. And really the heat removal is at delta Q. So it's that fluid or air that's going through the either chassis or around the chassis to actually provide the cooling to your electronics that provides most of the work. And for larger boards, like a 6U board versus a 3U board, you get quite a hysteresis in the center of the board. So managing the design of those boards with proper thermal spreaders, thermal materials, and thermal interface materials is paramount. So if you look at what I'd like to do now is go into thermal management subsystems. When I talk about the subsystem is once the cooled air or cooled liquid has got to be dumped into the platform from the electronic box or electronic board, what's the most effective and efficient way of doing that, both at the board level and at the box level and at the system level? And when I talk about thermal management systems, whether it be a passive system like a ram air system, we're using ram air in the aircraft to come through a radiator to cool a liquid, which is then pumped and circulated around the electronics, or a vapor cycle system, which is basically a refrigeration system that actually can directly cool the electronics, but in most applications today, cool the secondary liquid. All these systems contain heat exchangers, pumps, fans, compressors, valves, accumulators, sensors, and controllers, and all add up to the reliability and MTBF that you have to set up as rotary pieces of equipment like fans, pumps, and compressors tend to do quite well based upon today's reliability of these systems being done. It's still the electronics which typically drives MTBF today, only because of both performance, obsolescence, and the reliability of electronics. So when we look at a flow-through conduction cooling system, we'll show you three systems, just to simplify. Forced air, you've got a fan, whether the fan is pulling air in, or you've got ram air going through, pushed, can be directly directed through the sidewalls of a box with all these cards in it, and you can typically cool about 30 watts per slot or 150 watts total. When you're talking about a forced liquid, again, this is some data based on analysis done, whether it be air pulled through this heat exchanger with a fan, a smaller fan here, because we are forcing liquid, and the mass flow of the liquid is actually providing better cooling than the air. It's about less than 80 watts per slot or 600 watts total. And then finally, when we talk about an active system, a vapor cycle system, where you're using a vapor cycle system, which is a compressor, a condenser, you've got an expansion valve there, and an evaporator to transfer the cooling to a secondary liquid. And there you see the liquid cooling. You can actually make the fan smaller and pump smaller in this because you're actively cooling it. And again, it's a much more precise way of cooling. Direct refrigeration or two-phase material directly against the die has some of its issues because you have to be able to match up the refrigerant to the basic system, and you have issues such as dew point. You'll be able to manage it. With a secondary liquid, it's easier to do that. Secondly, in small cockpit areas or small areas like inside of the turret of a tank, typically refrigerant is almost a no-no because of potential asphyxiation issues and safety issues. So a secondary liquid is really today's way of doing it. Now, you could do it a lot better, like I said, with things like immersion boiling, where theoretically you could take out 2,000 kilowatts per meter per centimeter squared, theoretically. Now, it's only been tested about 200 kilowatts, immersion, but what do you do with all that fluid? How does that fluid interface with things? And by the way, that much fluid adds a lot of weight to the basic platform. Plus, once you've warmed up that fluid, you've got to dump the heat out somewhere else. And that's why most designers have relied on what we call hybrid systems, a combination of vapor cycle system and in the past sometimes an air cycle system with a secondary loop and again with this payload. And the rugged board and thermal transfer kits are crucial. It's how you get the heat from the board to the box and then conduct that, whether by air or liquid, still makes one of the most effective designs for aircraft and ground vehicles today. The difference in an aircraft, you can shut off the vapor cycle system after ground operations or low fast flight, because you've got the ability to use the ram air, the very cold ram air, and flying up. But ground vehicles have to have the vapor cycle system on all the time. It's like running the air conditioning in your car 24/7 as you're operating the car, and even more than that sometimes, because these electronics used for communications, for hotel loads, typically have to have their own power and cooling, and with the engine not running. So it has a completely different stack up of problems when you're talking about using advanced radars and even high-energy weapons, a next-generation ground ground vehicles. Now, here's the bottom line. You know, active cooling and thermal, what I call thermal economic analysis, this is SWAP versus COP. COP is actually the coefficient of performance, and a good COP of close to two, which we strive for with our VCSs, actually can really enhance a system, especially in an aircraft where you don't have to run the system all the time. You can be able to do the trades between the vapor cycle system and a rammer system. But it's all about effectiveness and efficiency. And for most people, we see these words and they mean different things to different people. I always say it's always between semantics and schematics. But here in a schematic, it's all about keeping the electronics cool. So if we now go to the system level, we see there are challenges. Forced air and forced liquid are really the systems that are implemented on today's system. If we look to sixth-generation fighter, there are new cores being developed for engines and looking at ways of using hybrid systems and being able to drive these active and passive systems. Because back in the fifth generation, a lot of the heat was dumped off into fuel. And fuel is a great thing, especially on takeoff where you have a lot of fuel and your fuel flow to your engines is very high. So if you're using the fuel flow or the basic fuel tank, it's a really good thing. But when you're trying to land where fuel flow into the engine is minimized and there's very little fuel in the tanks, combined with the fact that there's a lot of heat being generated by the actuation systems on flaps and control surfaces in trying to land, you run into a problem. So tomorrow's systems we see are modular hybrid systems, which give you the best balance of cooling power reliability. We still haven't solved the problem with adding a high-energy weapon, but it's getting us there. So if we look at now the system challenges, that, again, I believe if you look at these systems, you see that the combination of these will be challenged both in legacy and new platforms. And the modular application of a good vapor cycle system with a liquid cooling system with a hybrid system actually gives you probably the best bang for the buck for future systems. But how are we going to accommodate those next generation loads? And here's a couple examples. Here's a future vehicle, future tank, and a typical day with solar loads. And when you measure solar loads, you get about 50% reflected, but you take the surface area, you come up with solar loads in terms of the loading, and you see one of the highest loaded areas for cooling is coming from the sun. Now you have human loads, and a human will put off between 300 watts themselves. So this is a two-person tank. You look at the engine, and that's the parasitic loads coming through the wall of the engine. But when you add up the electronics, it's pretty high. You see the C4SI equipment and vehicle electronics and the vehicle defensive systems being large, but still nothing compared to a 10 kilowatt to a 200 kilowatt high energy system. And again, unlike a generator that may be up to 90% or 95% efficient, these things are very inefficient. You're talking 30 or 40% at best. So all that heat has to be managed, and that can ruin your day. Now, when we look at the Air Force projection, they haven't changed this chart in 5 years, but again, it's the same. Looking at today and the thermal loads in kilowatts, you see these advanced weapons. They're planning on possibly putting high-energy weapons both on their next-generation bomber, sixth-generation fighter. And to be able to do that, there are some things that have to change and to be creative. Dropping the thermal loads off into structure, fuel, and everything else has to be worked out and managed at really the platform level. So understanding your impact in terms of designing the cooling system just for the electronics has sizable impacts on the overall system. So, in summary, I've got some final thoughts here because thermal management systems are not just that simple, okay? There's things that impact system design and where we go with systems, and, you know, no greater one than cost. But there is changes in the base technology, the rate of change. You know, new thermal spreaders and thermal interface materials actually help to improve the distribution of thermal loads and thermal inertia within a system. Life cycle costs, power and cooling capacity requirements are going higher and higher and higher. Having your own generator for the cooling system, because the cooling system does take power from the normal operation and also adds weight and power and also size constraints, which I mentioned several times earlier in this presentation. Space requirements, the type of materials you pick, the coolant materials, the flow paths, the architecture, so the reliability, maintainability, enclosed materials, and flow paths, how you design the thing to be cooled and how you design those plant paths and the solenoids that have to be put in place to be able to switch between a hybrid system are all crucial in the initial design of the aircraft. And most important is really total life cycle cost. So in summary, I know I've gone through this pretty quick, but I really wanted to leave you with a feeling that, you know, thermal management systems truly must be economically balanced, okay, from a global and local standpoint. You can't come up with a great thermal management process or system at the chip level or the card level or board and forget about the subsystem and the platform it's going on. Fluids have much higher heat capacity than gas. We said it before, there are some fluids coming to the market that look pretty promising, but again, this is typically what we're doing today. I believe all thermal management systems to me need to be simple, modular, flexible, and cost-effective. Again, if we didn't need them, we wouldn't be spending money on thermal management systems. But the look of what's happening in both Moore being right about the functional density of electronics and military projections for ISR and high-energy weapons, is truly driving the system. And finally, Meggitt has been defining and developing affordable, reliable, global, local, and global thermal management solutions for military ground aircraft platforms for over 40 years. And I encourage any questions you have and a visit to our website. And again, I want to thank John, and I'd like to now turn it over to David O'Meara. Thank you.
And thank you, Jerry. John McHale jumping in here real quick. That was outstanding. And just a real quick little note to the audience to please get your questions ready to send off. And as soon as David is done speaking, our experts will be there to answer your questions. So David O'Meara, take it away.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, John, and thank you, Jerry, for that talk. Jerry's talk was more at the graduate level, and I'm going to kind of bring things down more to the undergraduate level. And I always like to start with the basics when talking about thermal management. And so with thermal management, reliability and temperature really have an adversarial relationship. As the temperature goes up, reliability goes down. And we can see this illustrated by a couple of equations. The one on the left is an equation that a lot of us mechanical engineers learned in school, and it illustrates quite clearly the inverse relationship of temperature to reliability. MIL Standard 217 handbook uses the equation on the right, and you can see that temperature plays a major role in that equation as well. So when talking about thermal solutions, there's a number of factors that we always need to consider, and this slide illustrates some of the major factors that we need to look at. So clearly environment is important, and as Jerry pointed out, when you're at altitude, the air is very thin, and this presents some unique thermal challenges, but there's also unique challenges in regards to ground, mobile, and naval application as well. We also need to be looking at the total amount of heat generated. Some systems today are fairly low power in the 15 to 40 watt range. Other high performance systems are 2 kilowatts and above. And of course, as the power increases, the thermal challenges also increase as well. Processor choice is a major factor in looking at a thermal solution. We also have to look at the major paths available for cooling, air, liquid, radiation, which I'll speak about here in a minute. You have to look at whether or not the MTBF requirements of the system allow you to use a fan. Fans tend to decrease the MTBF. Although fans are very efficient for removing heat, they do introduce a penalty in the system's design, which is the decreased MTBF. So Contron is a premier member of the Intel Solutions Alliance. And so when looking at processors, we need to be looking at what's available today in terms of the latest technologies. Intel offers dual and multi-core processors, which allow the systems designer to look at thermal performance and scale, not so much by scaling frequency, which is the old way of doing it, although you can still do that, but also by looking at the number of cores that you're using. And also Intel offers now the new 22 nanometer technology, which allows for very much improved compute performance with lower power consumption. So some of the technologies that Intel offers that we offer as well, Contron working with Intel. So some of these technologies are Turbo Boost, which allows the system to power off unused cores automatically. There is the SpeedStep technology, which allows the system to dither between active cores and idle cores to maximize the compute power, but also to maximize thermal performance. There is the configurable TDP functions, which allows further customization for performance, and also automated low power states for real-time computing applications. Now, there are a lot of really ingenious thermal solutions out on the market today, but the fact is that we live in a macro world, and as such, we are bound by the laws of classical physics. And classical physics starts with the laws as developed by Sir Isaac Newton. Those laws can be used to derive the laws of thermodynamics, or as we call it in the physics world, the statistical mechanics. And so at the end of the day, really, there's really three major ways that you can deal with heat. You can either get rid of it through conduction, you can get rid of it through convection, or you can deal with it through radiation. So this slide shows just kind of a graphic example of the three types of cooling. So conduction is basically just heat moving between two solids. Convection is heat being distributed through convective currents, either through air or liquid or some other type of gas. And radiation, of course, is the electromagnetic form of heat. And although radiation is not typically used as a primary source for removing heat, it always plays a role and needs to be considered in thermal design. So let's look at some real-world solutions. And one thing I want to emphasize to the audience is that sometimes it's tempting for the systems designer to come up with a beautiful system-level design and ignore the thermal challenges. And I've seen this many times in my career where thermal management is kind of the last thing to be considered. And this is very dangerous because you can have a beautiful solution, but if you can't cool it, then it, for all intents and purposes, it's kind of useless. So the four major types of thermal management are passive convection or active convection, the second bullet with forced air or liquid. There's passive conduction and there's active conduction. And I'm going to be going through some examples of these in the slides following. So to talk a little bit about radiation, even though, as I said, radiation is not normally a primary means of cooling, it really does need to be considered, especially for lower power systems. If you're in the sub 100 watt range, then radiation is definitely something that you need to consider because radiation is radiative cooling is always present, either as radiating heat away from the system, but also the system is absorbing heat by radiation from adjacent equipment. So an example of passive convection is Contron's Cobalt system. Cobalt is a small form factor, single board computer, specifically designed for environments where swap is important, low weight, and high compute efficiency. Again, this is a passive convection system. There's no fan. The heat is dealt with strictly by convective currents of air moving about the system. Cobalt is a 30 watt or so system, can operate up to 71 degrees C ambient, which is fairly aggressive. So we did some analytical and empirical studies of cobalt here at Contron, and the example shown on the page is we took a baseline for cobalt, and we show that at a nominal power load, we see that the delta T, the change in temperature between the CPU core temperature and the ambient air was about 11 degrees C. And this was in a 71 degree C oven. So that's our baseline. And so we looked at various variations on that theme in terms of environment. So if we mount the cobalt on a cold plate, you can see on the column with the yellow color that the impact to delta T is quite dramatic. So we get a 20% improvement just by mounting it on a cold plate. In the middle of the chart, you can see the dramatic effect of altitude on cooling. So as the altitude increases, the air density decreases, and therefore you have less air to conduct heat away, and you can see that you can see the degradation of the core temperature as you go up in altitude. The last box at the bottom shows the effect of radiative effects. So what we did is we mounted a couple of radiating boxes next to cobalt and had it radiate heat into cobalt, and you see that the efficiency decreased by about 15%. So you can see that radiation does play a really critical role, and as we design our systems for our customers, we always take into account the effects of radiation, because especially for low power systems, this becomes significant. The next slide at the top, we took cobalt and we mounted it inside a box to remove any air currents. In the real world, there's always some amount of air, even though nominally there is no fan on the system. In fact, when you have a system that's airborne or ground mobile, there's always small air currents surrounding the box. And even though these air currents, their velocities can be quite low, they're very important, and they actually can introduce a considerable amount of additional cooling aside from pure convective currents alone. But if you remove all of those ambient air currents and put cobalt in a still box, you can see that the delta T increases quite dramatically. So we had an 11 degree C delta T at the baseline, and now it's 22 degrees C. But even though it's 22 degrees C, it's still a very efficient way of cooling. But even with that said, the effect of adjacent air currents is still important, and we do take that into account when we are designing our systems. And finally, at the bottom, you can see a couple of examples of mounting cobalt in various orientations and what its effect is on the cooling. At the very bottom of the slide, you can see the effect of changing the CPU clock frequency. And this is a technique that can be used many times. Even though you have a very powerful CPU in the system, you may not need all that power. And one very easy and almost free way of dealing with temperature is to just simply decrease the clock frequency. And you can see how dramatic that is with the percentages on the right. An example of active convection is a system that has an active fan that's physically blowing air across the boards. The example shown on the screen is Contron's FS1207. This is a 7-slot system. We can provide it with either compact PCI or VME or VPX backplanes. The graphic on the right shows the air velocity, theoretical air velocity currents across the boards. So when we are designing our systems, we use a CFD modeling. CFD stands for Computational Fluid Dynamic Modeling. The software package, there's many different versions of this, but the package that we use allows for some quite useful graphics. And so the image on the upper left shows the air vectors in an example chassis. And these vectors, the colors, show the velocity. And, of course, the little spaghetti curves show you where the air is going. And this allows us to very accurately throttle the air across certain slots. If we need to increase air across the single board computer slot, and maybe decrease the air across the I/O slot, we can do that. So the modeling allows us to generate what we call a system impedance curve, and that's shown in the upper right. And once that system impedance curve is defined, then what we do is we overlay fan impedance curves, which is the image on the lower right, and where the two curves cross, this is what we call the operating point of the system, and this tells us exactly how much air we can expect to see moving through the system. We found over the years, we've been doing this for a long time, that when we model the system and predict an air flux through the system, And then if we take that same system and put it in a what we call the blue tube, which is the image shown on the left, and actually measure the actual air going through the system, we are very, very accurate between what we've shown analytically versus what we are showing empirically. We're usually accurate to within better than 5%. So this is a very efficient way of designing a system where you can dial in the thermal performance before any metal is cut or before any components are physically installed. An example of passive conduction is a cold plate type of application. So this image shows our FS5977 cold plate chassis. This is a 6U chassis. And this is actually a very efficient way of dealing with heat. You can get rid of several hundred watts of power with no fan, simply by mounting the chassis on a cold plate. And depending upon the cold plate temperature, you can get a fairly large amount of heat out of the system and still maintain a high MTBF, which is, for military use, is always critical. So this slide shows a little bit more detail of active conduction, how active conduction works. So we're still in the conductive portion of thermal management, but in this example, the board is clamped to a heat sink with a wedge lock, and then that assembly is then mechanically married to a channel with either moving air or moving liquid, and this just shows how the heat is distributed, and we can see that there's about 30% of the heat goes out through on the wedge lock side, and 70% goes out through on the board side. Wedge locks have been around for a long, long time. They can generate huge amounts of clamping force, which is why they're used. It's a very simple assembly, but that little image on the right, that wedge lock, when tightened to 10 or 20 inches of torque, it'll generate several hundred pounds of clamping force. It's a very efficient little mechanical device for physically coupling the board to your chassis. This example is a pictorial of an active conduction system. It's a 6U 1ATR system. You can see the wedge lock in the picture. The fan is mounted in the rear, and we always have the fan pull air through the box rather than pushing air through the box. And the reason for that is that if the fan were pushing air through the box, you would be introducing the heat of the fan into the system, which you don't want to do. So we always have the air being pulled from the front of the box out through the rear so that you're pulling in the cool ambient air to cool your electronics. This graph, this slide shows some results of our CFD modeling of that same chassis that we were looking at on the previous slide. This is a 400-watt system that's currently flying on a P8 Sonobuoy system. And the different colors that you see on the slide are what we call isotherms. And so these are areas of constant temperature, and the box on the right basically shows what that average wall temperature is. This slide is an example of a liquid system that we developed for a land mobile application. This was back in the future combat system days. This is a 600-watt system. It was a VPX-based active protection system. This uses liquid, and this particular box was unique in that the liquid slots used microchannel technology. So it's kind of counterintuitive. You would think that the more liquid you could force through a system, the better cooling you would have, but that's often not the case, because if you're forcing large volumes of liquid through the system, you set up a lot of chaotic movement of the liquid in the system, and the thermal efficiency drops. So this uses microchannel technology, fairly thin walls. We're talking maybe 20 thousandths width of a hydraulic channel, which is very, very small. But as you go down in width of your hydraulic channel, the thermal efficiency actually increases, and we were able to remove very large amounts of heat with fairly a little amount of liquid flowing through it. So in conclusion, I would like to encourage our listeners to please consider thermal management early in your design. It'll help you reduce cost. It'll help you increase efficiency. And, please contact the experts, companies like Contron and Meggitt. We have very experienced engineers on staff. We can help you with these challenges. And again, basically, when you're looking at thermal solutions, you need to be looking at what the environment is, what the platform is. MTBF is critical in choosing your components. And, of course, processing requirements. And with today's modern highly advanced processors sold by Intel, you can get very, very high compute performance with very low thermal penalty. And so I thank you for your attention today. Look forward to taking your questions. And, John, back to you.
Thank you, David. Excellent presentation, and Jerry as well. Both of you, when you were on a webcast together, you were always outstanding. Now to our questions from the audience. First question is for Jerry. Jerry, where is all the additional power coming from for future systems?
John, that's an excellent question. You know, we only have to look to the 787 as a commercial platform to see where the more electric airplane is coming for. And in that aircraft, there was this 500, KVA electric motor that actually is driven from the engines, which are almost bleedless today. And if you look at engines, like I mentioned before, like Gen X or Rolls-Royce Trent 1000s, that their generators are capable of delivering that each. 500 KVA is approximately four times the amount of electrical power that was generated from the 747 individual engines. So there's a significant amount coming from the engines, as the engines are driven to be driving generators. Now, but that hits a certain limit. And so we're seeing on a lot of platforms, especially when you're talking about high-energy weapons, you need to have a lot of thermal storage, both thermal batteries, but more importantly, electrical storage. So you're seeing more and more batteries, okay, for those subsystems to be able to perform, because those duty cycles of being able to take a 150-kilowatt laser, shoot it for 60 seconds, shut it down for like a couple of minutes, shoot it again for 60, requires a significant amount of power. And again, unlike the generators, which I said were like 95% efficiency, which would equate to about 50 kilowatts of excess heat, those energy weapons are not that efficient at all. So you've got a whole bunch of heat coming. So where I see the extra power coming from is not from the new design and these new engines for both today's aircraft and sixth-generation fighters, but from auxiliary power units. And in many cases, and on the aircraft, there could be a ram air turbine that will act as a generator, okay, to provide that extra oomph and power for some of these subsystems. And on the ground vehicles, there's also, ways of actually linking things together and adding more generative power off a PTO and inside of an engine to drive a larger vapor cycle system or a combined system. So everybody's thinking about it, but I'm not sure everybody is ready. You know, one of the things that came out of that IPC report from PCM for looking at trends till 2019, almost all the board manufacturers expect clock speeds to get up to 25 gigahertz. Now, that alone is going to generate a lot more heat, not just these engine systems, but the electronics themselves. So it takes a complete design to understand what that total system value is going to be for thermal loads, and then be able to generate enough power so it does not impact the primary mission of the aircraft or the ground vehicle to use it.
Thank you, Jerry. Next question is for David. David, how do you deal with high-altitude applications in regard to thermal management?
Okay, that's a great question. So, again, with high altitude, the air is very, very thin, although at high altitude, of course, the air temperature is very low. So even though the air is thin, the ambient temperature is low, so that's a huge help. When designing for a high altitude, of course, you don't want to – if you're at very high altitude, if you're at 50,000, 60,000 feet, you don't really want to have a fan on your box because it really doesn't do you any good. There's very, very thin air up there. So a lot of people will, although you can have a fan, there are applications where there are fans at those altitudes. But for those applications, many times our customers will actually mechanically couple the box to a cold section of the aircraft. It could be ram air or some other avenue like that. But for high altitude, it's very, very important to understand that you intuitively you would think, oh, we'll just put a fan on the box. Well, you can't do that. you have to get a little bit more creative in your solutions. So that's why it's really important that you consult people that, thermal designers that do this stuff for a living and understand what the constraints are.
Thank you, David. You guys are both talking about aircraft platforms, but Jerry, you mentioned how it's more challenging as well in ground systems. I've heard it often said that the problem with current ground platforms is they were not designed from the ground up with power in mind. Is that still a challenge? Are the new vehicles coming out, the next-gen vehicles, are you seeing them taking power into thought from the beginning? What I mean by that is they would add on all this equipment later on and then say, how are we going to solve the power and thermal issues instead of thinking about it from the ground up? Do you see that mindset being adapted in future vehicles, or is it still the same old thing?
Well, you see a new platforms like JLTV or what the next generation combat vehicle that the Army is working on. They are taking that into consideration with larger generators on the engines from the get-go. But again, this is a dynamic situation as such that, every 2 to 3 years, that changes. The type of radios, communications we use, the advent of ACA radars have just impacted all subsystems, today, and I see that continuing. So it's not only being able to prepare for it for today, which some of the ground vehicles actually have inherent in the design, and also sometimes have a separate auxiliary power unit just for running hotel loads, but it's being able to adapt to changes and even more electrical loads in the future. The greatest constraints of trying to upgrade a Bradley or an Abrams today is the available power that's generated by the tank itself or by the fighting vehicle. And as you see, most of the things that have happened in our industry have been those upgrades. But in the future, for things like JLTV and other platforms, they are taking into consideration. I just hope that they got their thermal analysis done properly because, missing it, it can cause huge problems across the system.
Thank you, Jerry. Next question is for David. David, what is a typical card edge temperature that you design to?
Okay, another really good question. So many of the board vendors, Contron included, we will rate our card edge temperature at around 85 degrees C, but this is really a maximum. We tend to not try to drive those card edge temperatures that high because, as I said in my talk, with increasing temperature, your reliability is going to go down. So we typically like to design in, the 75 degree C range for a card edge temperature. And this can be achieved, again, through using a wedge lock or through some other means. But typically, you really don't want to run that card edge temperature up to its maximum rating, which is, as I said, is typically around 85 degrees C. Try to shoot for a range of 75 degrees C, maybe up into the 80 degrees C range. But anything above that, you're starting to get into a range where the reliability really starts to suffer.
Thank you. Next question from the audience is, for active conduction cooling of 6U PWBs, do the boards need metal frames to conduct heat to wedge lock rails? I think that's for you, Dave.
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, metallic substances are much higher in thermal conductivity than non-metallic substances. So typically, the hot components on the board will be mechanically married to like a copper heat plane within the board, and then that copper plane is then driven out to the edge. And sometimes the board itself is mounted into a metal frame, which is then wedge locked to the system. So that is a very common technique for cooling. And copper and aluminum are pretty high in terms of thermal conductivity, much higher than steel. So that's typically what you'll see out of the market.
Thanks, Dave. Dave, I have a question. Earlier in your slide presentation, you talked about the benefits of what Intel is providing at the chip level to help you with thermal management. Do you guys do much with FPGAs? Anything happening there on thermal management that's benefiting military system design?
We do. In terms of the actual thermal solution for FPGAs, I'm probably not the right person, unfortunately, John, to answer that question, but we do have a fairly active development program in that regard, and for the specifics of that, I would encourage folks to get in touch with our product management here to get some more details.
Thank you. Next question for Jerry. What subsystems elements negatively impact mean time between failure?
Well, typically in one of these thermal management systems, it's first the rotary pieces of equipment, those things that move, like a fan, a pump, or a compressor. But to a greater extent, it's typically the electronics, especially with the advent of permanent magnet motors. And typically those are driven by power drive modules to do the computation of the motors. Those things not only add heat, but they also reduce the MTBF. So it's a combination of both electronics and the rotary equipment. But, you know, today's thermal management systems tend to be very good in terms of MTBF and are excellent until the thermal loads are changed.
All right, thanks. And to the audience, keep those questions coming in. We have about 4 to 5 minutes left, so we can still take a couple more questions. Next question. I think this is for Dave. How do you fabricate the 0.020 wide microchannels in a chassis?
Oh, okay. Well, this is that's a good question. Somebody's thinking out there. So these there's a variety of techniques for doing this, but typically what we'll do is we will machine those side panels in two parts. So you'll have kind of a positive and a negative portion, and then those two parts, when they are physically put together, like the one side will have like a little island machined on it, and then the opposite side that it mates to will have a little depression. And when you put those two together, that creates this very, very small channel. And typically these assemblies are put together in what's called vacuum brazing. So that assembly will be put together. There'll be a brazing material sandwiched in between the plates with a flux. Typically, it's in the form of a ribbon or a sheet. And then those two are mechanically clamped. They're put into an oven. The air is pumped out to remove any oxidants from the environment. The whole assembly is then heated up, and the brazing compound melts. The flux facilitates wetting of the surfaces, and the two get welded together. And you take it out, and you've got your plate. And you can basically achieve any type of microchannel thickness you need with that technique. It's actually very, very simple to do.
Yeah, if I may add, because we've been flying liquid flow through microchannel boxes for over 15 years on different air platforms, that typically we'll go through it exactly what Dave said. It's a brazing process. But we'll put a serpentine channel in it and then add some fin stock. And the fin stock is very thin fins that you would see in a typical plate fin heat exchanger. And those things are put into the channels to add more surface area and also structurally help, because the brazing compound against the fin stock into the channel provides a better way of transferring loads and pressure loads. Because these things are always tested to over 300x their normal design requirement for fluid. And again, we've been flying these things for well over 15. I think we've got some things up there probably close to 20 years now that have been flying on classified vehicles.
Okay. Thank you, Jerry. Next question from the audience. Could you discuss any types of power management systems that could automatically adjust clock frequencies or circuit functions to decrease power consumption? Who would like to take a stab at that one?
I spoke briefly about that with our Intel technology, yeah. And the Intel these thermal management technologies are very, very efficient, and I would recommend for a really detailed discussion on that you go either to the Contron website and look up some white papers on Intel technology, or you can go directly to Intel. But there are very, very sophisticated and very advanced systems now on these chips that allow for automated power consumption. And these can be adjusted by the end user through some fairly quick programming subroutines. But with today's technology, especially with the nanometer technology, the power consumptions are fairly efficient for a very high compute capability. But in addition to that, of course, are all these techniques. And I had mentioned some of these turbo boost and speed step and so forth that I would encourage the person that asked this question to go download some white papers to get a little bit more educated on that.
Thank you, David. Next question for Jerry. Do ground carts help improve size, weight, and power?
You know, that's an excellent question for aircraft, because many people don't realize is that one of the most difficult design conditions for an advanced electronic sensor or system that requires cooling is on the ground. When the aircraft is started up without having full engine power, APU, or any air flowing, so typically we have to add a ground fan to a cooling system just to be able to cool the condenser or the heat exchanger to provide liquid cooling or air cooling to the basic electronics. It's really the worst case. So many use ground carts, very similar to what you see in the commercial airline industry, where you have air conditioning cart where they hook up a large tube to the aircraft and help to augment the air management system in an aircraft. The problem, though, and it does help to make the system smaller, because if you can eliminate that ground case for the design, you can actually make the system smaller and more swap efficient. But you have to have the ground cart, and that's the crux. So every military base that you fly into or every base you plan to land that aircraft at, you need to have that type of cart there to be able to provide that, or you won't be able to turn on the electronics or be able to run the sensors or run bit check in some of these systems, because, again, the worst case in many of these aircraft is the loads required while the airplane is parked but turned on.
Thank you, Jerry. Last question is for David. David, as Contron is a provider of many different small form factors and open standards, with the current environment kind of going more toward that way in terms of commonality, use of standards across systems, and the government's even embracing that more, how does that help solve thermal management issues, especially when you have so many different types of platforms with different size constraints?
Well, actually, the small form factor actually increases the challenge for thermal management. It doesn't in and of itself help. But the of course with the higher compute efficiencies of some of these advanced Intel chips, of course we can get by with designing these small form factor systems and maintain very, very high compute performance. So the small form factor itself, it doesn't buy you much in terms of thermal efficiency. And like I said, in fact, if anything, it kind of hurts you. But that's where we have to get even more creative on how we deal with heat. And with the new small form factor systems that we are designing and continuing to improve, I think you're going to continue to see an improvement in overall computing capacity with the decrease in thermal requirements for the system. So over the next year or two, you're going to continue to see some dramatic improvements in that area.
Excellent. An excellent way to end it. Looking forward to seeing those improvements. And I'd like to thank Jerry Janicki and David O'Mara for speaking today on the webcast, and Contron for sponsoring the event. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. I want to thank you all for attending. I look forward to seeing you on future Military Embedded Systems eCast. Goodbye.